Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, welcome to the podcast. Now, this week, Human Rights Watch, which is by no stretch a radical organisation, it's a very mainstream human rights organisation, has condemned Israel for being guilty of apartheid. The occupation of Palestinian lands has gone on for decades, a brutal and illegal occupation. And we've seen, of course, the situation degenerate ever further for the Palestinian people who are deprived of the right to national self-determination. So today what we're doing is we're talking to Hanan Ashrawi, who is a very prominent Palestinian politician, a scholar, served as a member of the leadership committee, has been an official spokesperson of the Palestinian delegation to the Middle East peace process, and served as Palestinian Authority Minister of Higher Education and Research. Her activism, her work goes back many, many decades. She was born before the foundation of Israel itself. So we're going to talk to her about the situation in Palestine and what we can do for those of us who live in the West. Do support this podcast if you can, and channel on Patreon, and help decide who we talk to and what issues we talk about, or use the support function in the description. Do give us 5 stars and leave a review if you're feeling, you know, just like you want to support us, really. And also subscribe. With that said, please listen carefully to this. It's so important to Hanan Ashrawi. So I'm very honoured to be joined today by Hanan Ashrawi, who is a pillar of the Palestinian cause for so many decades, a statesperson, a politician, a diplomat, a campaigner, an academic, a writer, you name it. She's been on our television screens for so long throughout the decades and has become inextricably tied in the popular imagination with the Palestinian cause. So thank you so much for joining us today, Hanan.
Thank you, Owen. It's great to be with you.
So Human Rights Watch, which is probably regarded as the most mainstream human rights organisation internationally, has issued a report directly accusing Israel of apartheid. And I'd like to begin by asking what your response is to that report, and also to those who are sceptical, perhaps, in their response to the report, which accuses Israel directly of apartheid.
Well, first of all, this is not a report in isolation or in a vacuum. This is a report that comes as part of an incremental process, let's say, in which international organizations and so on have been looking at the situation, documenting Israeli violations, looking at the lives of Palestinians, and determining that this is a situation of apartheid. As you remember, it was Desmond Tutu said it. He even said it was worse than apartheid. Jimmy Carter said it, and he wrote his book that said Peace, Not Apartheid, and all hell broke loose. And of course, Yesh Din did it, B'Tselem did it, the human rights organizations, and now, of course, Human Rights Watch. The Palestinians have been saying it's a displacement-replacement paradigm, which is what Ilan Pape described it as, in which they're attempting to displace and replace a whole nation with another, with our history, our culture, our presence, our land. Everybody looked at it in Palestine as a settler colonial endeavor in which Israel has created a system that gives all rights to Israeli Jews and no rights whatsoever to Palestinians under occupation and within Israel, what later became Israel, and has gotten away with it, literally. So by having mainstream organizations, as you said, come out and openly discuss the issue of the crime against humanity, although the ICC, the International Criminal Court, talked about war crimes, settlements, and so on. These are crimes against humanity that involve apartheid and that involve repression. So both, in a sense, are a description of a situation in which Israel is not just in a state of occupation or permanent occupation of Palestinian land, but in a state of systemic and institutionalized and even legalized oppression, discrimination, repression, treating the Palestinians one way, creating a situation of tremendous hardship and disenfranchisement and disempowerment for the victims of the occupation, while granting Israel as an occupying power full immunity to act with impunity without any type of intervention or accountability. So to me, the importance of this is that it's becoming part of the global conversation. It is no longer sort of taboo to describe the situation, because Israel, as always, you know, blames everybody. It doesn't look at what it's doing, but it attacks those who describe what Israel is doing, including the UN and the UN Human Rights Council, including Israeli human rights organizations and global human rights organizations, by saying this is all anti-Israel, or this is all anti-Semitic, or they have an anti-Israel agenda, or whatever. So instead of reading the reports and taking them seriously, Israel just starts attacking and labeling and maligning anybody who dares question Israeli and describe, let alone question, Israeli violations in Palestine. So now it is up to the international community to see or to translate these descriptive terms, these statistical issues, and they're clearly supported by evidence. The situation is given, is very credible, because it's not just a conclusion. It is based on careful research, observation, and statistics. So now, what does the world want to do? Shall we pursue, will they continue granting Israel the cover, granting Israel leeway, space, and time to wreak havoc, to continue with these policies that are essentially inherently racist, exclusivist, and exclusionary? Or are they going to take action, to take steps in order to curb these, number one, to put an end to such a behavior and to hold Israel to account? But the dynamic cannot continue like this, and descriptive statements are not enough. And issuing statements of denunciation or concern or care is not enough. What you need to do is take your responsibility seriously within even multilateral organizations, within legal and judicial structures and institutions, and put an end to Israel's preferential treatment, to Israel's sense of entitlement, and its holding captive a whole nation of Palestine and literally getting away with murder.
Last week, a group of extremists from Israel charged into occupied Jerusalem, yelling death to Arabs, and attacked Palestinians. I mean, huge numbers of Palestinians were injured. I suppose my question is, what's the wider, I mean, a horrific event, but what's the wider significance of it? Because the Israeli authorities would wash their hands of this and say, these are extremists that have nothing to do with this. So what does that one, just one example, that one event, what's the wider significance? What does it tell us?
Well, that one event is clearly symptomatic of an ongoing pattern of behavior. We've heard this statement, death to the Arabs, repeatedly. We've seen it written and with graffiti all over people's homes and cars and so on. We've seen the settlers go on the rampage, and the extremist settlers and the militias and groups, and threaten whole villages, and particularly rural and isolated people, and destroy crops and beat up Palestinians and so on. So it's an ongoing and escalating pattern. They are now emboldened. Why? Because you have a serious shift to the extreme racist, violent right, because they've been given, again, room and space to continue. Because when they do these things, they are never held to account, they are never stopped. But the Israeli army protects them and attacks their victims. They attack Palestinians when the settlers, and we call this a reign of terror, when the settlers go on the rampage. So the Israeli army, in a sense, acts in coordination with the settlers and protects them even when they are attacking Palestinians. The army attacks the Palestinians, which is what happened in Jerusalem. Now, with Netanyahu also entering into coalitions with the Kahanists, some of the most hateful and hate-filled organizations that are outside the law, that were labeled by Israel as you know, Meir Kahana and his group, were labeled as terrorists. Even the U.S. labeled them as terrorists. But now they have been picked up and dusted off, and they have been granted not just an audience. They have participated in elections. Netanyahu supported them, encouraged them, and entered into an alliance with them, where they are now in the Knesset, in the parliament. And they are very active members of his extreme right-wing coalition. So you're seeing this shift, this total shift, the extreme right, the ideological right, the racist right, and the violent right. And it's extremely dangerous. It's dangerous for us, it's dangerous for the Palestinians everywhere, under occupation and within Israel. And of course in Jerusalem in particular, because they have a declared agenda of ethnic cleansing, of getting rid of the Palestinians. And they're saying this is what they should do. I mean, those who do not give total allegiance to Israel have to be kicked out. And they're trying basically in Jerusalem per se, because they want Jerusalem to be an exclusively Jewish city. Now, East Jerusalem is primarily a Palestinian city with a Palestinian culture and heritage and history. So what they're doing now is trying to transform the character of Jerusalem, trying to terrorize and intimidate the Palestinians of Jerusalem, over 350,000 of them, in order to get rid of them and in order to finish the illegal annexation and transformation of that city. And you know, when this group of Kahanists organized, decided that they're going to march into East Jerusalem through Damascus Gate, because this is where the people who are praying in Al-Aqsa Mosque come out after prayers, especially in Ramadan, and they sit and they have programs in Damascus Gate. Since the beginning of Ramadan, the Israeli government decided to put up these metal barricades to prevent the Palestinians after prayers from getting there and from sitting there and from having any type of presence. And that inflamed everybody, because this is a direct interference in a ritual, in a Ramadan ritual. And then with these extremist thugs threatening this, yelling death to the Arabs, and they even had broadcasts that they're going to bring weapons with them. So the army came in, the border guards came in, and instead of preventing these Israeli militias from coming to Damascus Gate, they tried to evacuate Damascus Gate from the Palestinians. And they used violence and so on. So they provoked another confrontation. And to the Palestinians, particularly the younger generation, this is something that strikes at the core of their existence, of their identity, of their rights in Jerusalem. And so, as I said, it is extremely dangerous. It is symptomatic of where things are heading. And this is the legacy also of the Trump administration, that emboldened these elements within Israel even further, and fascism became acceptable, and land theft became civilized, and intimidation and terrorism against the Palestinians was treated with extreme tolerance, let's put it that way. So it's very important that we place it in context, Owen, and I'm glad that you asked this question.
A traditional demand has been for a two-state solution, for a viable, independent Palestine based on pre-1967 borders. But some would now argue that that has simply become impossible, and that now the demand should be for a single state, maybe a binational state, a federal state, because of the nature of what's happened in terms of the settlements, the annexations, and so on. Over the last few years. What would you say on that, the issue of two states versus one state?
Yeah, I think this became a real political argument and discussion and debate, if you will. And I keep saying, let's not get into that. Let's not talk about one state or two states. To the Palestinians, actually, accepting the two-state solution was a major compromise, because historically, the Palestinians always said, we said that it is all Palestine, that we want one state, which is Palestine, a democratic, tolerant, pluralistic, inclusive state in which everybody can live in peace and harmony. Of course, that agenda in 1968 was turned down. And since then, Israel has been given free rein, has been given a free hand and encouragement, not just to annex the territory it occupied, it had in 1948, it conquered in 48, but also to continue expansion, particularly with the territory it occupied in 67. And so you ended up with the Palestinians having no control over any land, and even with the agreements, the Declaration of Principles, or what is known as the Oslo Agreements, they did not deal with the issue of Palestinian sovereignty, of Israeli withdrawal, of dismantlement of settlements, of all the real issues that should have been dealt with. So Israel felt that it had a free hand to continue its settlement activities, since that is a postponed issue, to continue changing the character of Jerusalem, and to continue taking more land, evicting people, demolishing homes, and so on, turning the Palestinians into residents of Jerusalem and then revoking their residency as part of ethnic cleansing. So they continued with their policies as a result either of the agreement or of being given support and encouragement by external forces. So the two-state solution was something that was demanded by the international community. We were told, in order to prove that we are peaceful, that we are civilized, that we live within the confines of international law, we have to accept 242 and 338 and the two-state solution. Well, we said there are other issues. The core of the problem is also the refugee problem, the total transformation of the state of Palestine, the historical realities and cultural realities of Palestine, the loss and negation of human rights and any type of sovereignty for Palestinians. There are many issues that are not addressed by 242, 338 and the two-state solution. We're not dealing just with the last piece of land that Israel conquered and is gradually annexing, but the core, the whole issue of the establishment of the state of Israel and the price that the Palestinians paid for no fault of their own for this establishment of the state and for the policies and measures that the state adopted against the Palestinians. Now we are being told, okay, so you accepted the two-state solution. The PLO did in 1988, as you know. Now it is not possible, because let's see how much land Israel can take from the 22% remaining 22% of historical Palestine. This is ridiculous. So Israel kept expanding. Israel kept building more settlements. Nobody stopped it. Settlements are a war crime, according to the Rome Statute of the ICC. And yet it persisted. And the whole world sat back and watched Israel destroy the two-state solution, which is it's a global consensus. It is the preferred solution for the international community. And it is a very convenient excuse to do nothing, to just watch Israel expand and then to say, no, no, this is wrong. We are supporters. We support the two-state solution. Israel must not do this. And then they pat themselves on the shoulder and say, we've done our national duty. We are for the two-state solution. So it became an excuse not to do anything, not to adopt any other policy. And this emboldened Israel even further to get to the point where when during the administration of Trump, the term occupation was dropped entirely from the lexicon. Israel was allowed to annex, and they recognized the annexation of Jerusalem as well as the annexation of the Golan Heights in violation of international law and UN resolutions and so on. And then they started, you know, labeling settlement products as made in Israel. So that they were creating facts as partners in crime with Israel that would only lead to a greater Israel, not a one-state solution, but the superimposition of greater Israel over all of Palestine, all of historical Palestine. Now, if you tell me, would I choose one or the other and so on, I tell you very frankly, given the current dynamic and realities on the ground, neither solution is available or is a solution. Because Israel has done everything possible to render the embodiment, I don't want to say creation, because we are recognized as a state by the UN and by 138 countries. And without having this recognition, we couldn't have gone to the ICC, for example, and we couldn't have joined many international organizations that we joined in order to protect our rights, our land, our resources, and so on. So that's not the argument. The argument is how do we effect a system in which Israel is held accountable and its violations are curbed, and in which the Palestinians are afforded protection in order to get the rights and freedom. That's the approach now. How do you do that? How do you maintain Palestinians' ability to remain on the land? How do we maintain the resilience? Because what we're facing daily is just horrendous. I mean, we talk about a reign of terror of settlers, we talk about home demolitions, we talk about extrajudicial executions, we talk about arbitrary detentions, we talk about administrative detention without evidence, without trial. Everything, every violation you can think of is being exercised daily against the Palestinians. So this is what we have to deal with now. How do you put an end to these Israeli violations? How do you get the international community with its instruments and institutions to hold Israel to account? How do you find means of protection for the Palestinians? And then we will move ahead. But to end up discussing, you know, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin or something, this is really an argument that is not right now within this context is not valid. What's valid to me is that we want our rights. Yes, we want all our rights, including the right to self-determination. We want to be free on our own land. Now, should people sit back and wait until there is a de facto one-state solution? Should we talk about a demographic reality that would threaten the state? And by the way, the nation-state law that Israel adopted a couple of years back is one of the most racist laws that you know any nation can adopt by saying only Jews have the right to self-determination, which means even those who have Israeli citizens, the Palestinians who have Israeli citizenship, have no right to self-determination. Therefore, it is perfectly legitimate to discriminate against them, which is what's being done in Israel. There are Israeli citizens, the Palestinians, the original Palestinians who stayed when Israel was created. And there is a system of legal, educational, financial, and so on, discrimination against them within Israel. And now they've legislated the nation state law that says it's okay. If you're not Jewish, you don't have full rights in the state of Israel. And what adds to that, contributes to the definition of apartheid, is that the Palestinians are under a different law entirely in the West Bank and Jerusalem and Gaza. each has a different set, each set of Palestinians has a different set of laws. The Palestinians of Jerusalem are treated as residents, but with no rights. They could easily lose their residency and therefore their right to stay in their city and so on. They don't have the right to build on their own land. The Israel gives itself the right to decide to give or withhold permits. What's left is 12% of the land of Jerusalem, and Israel doesn't allow Palestinians to build. So they demolish homes. And the same way in the West Bank, you have areas A, B, and C, and Israel acts as if areas C are Israeli territory, de facto annexed. And therefore, it doesn't allow people to build and doesn't allow them to even till their own lands, and it transforms the whole swaths of land into military maneuvers, areas for military maneuvers so that they can annex them later, or areas of natural green areas and so on. So you do have a whole system of oppression and a whole system of intimidation that seeks to reorganize, whether demographically or geographically, to reorganize and to engineer a reality in which Israel can exercise full control and full sovereignty while transforming Palestinians into self-enclosed Bantustans with a different set of laws, of course, with no rights whatsoever, under military rule. And this military rule, where they control the entrances and the exits, the territory, the airspace, the waters and so on of Palestine. This military rule has no responsibility whatsoever, as you have seen with the vaccines, where Israel refused to vaccinate the Palestinians under its control as a belligerent occupant and said, no, it's the responsibility of the Palestinian leadership to vaccinate. But you control everything, and it is your responsibility by law. Instead, they vaccinated all the Israelis. They had extra vaccines, so they did that with the laborers, the Palestinian laborers who work in Israel or in the settlements, because they come in touch with Israelis in Israel and in the settlements. And they started sending out extra vaccines to countries in exchange for their moving their capital to Jerusalem, embassy to Jerusalem. So it's a real manipulation of a human situation. Now, is this the one state I want to be in? No. Do I want greater Israel? No. This is what the international community has allowed to happen. Now, if we go back and say, okay, no, let's all work towards a one-state solution and agree that it has to be a state for all its peoples. And if you say that in Israel, you're accused of treason, where you say all people have to have equal rights and so on. This isn't happening, and it's not available, because the whole system is based on the total exclusion and oppression of the Palestinian people, regardless of where they are, and not just enabling the most extreme and racist government in Israel, but also making the settlers one of the instruments of Israeli power and control, not just the army and not just the government. So you have a situation here which, if allowed to run its course, is going to generate more extremism, more violence, more racism, more hostility, and threatens not to allow any solution to happen.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Successive US administrations of all stripes of both political parties have supported and armed Israel. Under Donald Trump, of course, there was, I suppose, a similar brand of politics shared between Netanyahu and Trump himself. And obviously the US, amongst other things, supported Israel officially designating Jerusalem as its capital. Do you see any prospects for change under the new US administration at all? Is there any hope, any optimism whatsoever? And how does that interact with the likely political composition of the Israeli government?
Well, frankly speaking, not a single American administration has been even-handed or has dealt with us fairly. The strategic alliance with Israel, maintaining Israel's military edge, qualitative military edge. I'm sure you've heard of the QME forever. The fact that there is no daylight between the US and Israel, a refrain we've heard repeatedly. Israel is our very special ally and so on. The billions and billions, not just $3.8 billion a year that go to Israeli military, the military arsenal of Israel, but also preferential treatment, tax-free support, people even like Jason Greenblatt and Friedman and Trump and his son, Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, sorry, Jared Kushner, contributed to the settlements and are complicit in war crimes. But let's say that every single American administration looked at the Palestinians only in relation to Israel. They even looked at the whole region in relation to what's good for Israel. This Israeli prism dominated. And they felt a sense of not just identification, which was clearly false, because they said we have shared values. And I kept saying, what values? I mean, occupation, oppression, killing people, kicking people out of their homes and so on. Are these the values you want for the US? They call it the only democracy in the region, which is extremely ironic, because to us what Israel is doing is exactly what no democratic country should do to another country. You do not have permission to enslave a whole nation and hold it captive and steal whatever they have and oppress its people systematically and systemically. So this kind of approach, even in negotiations, was brought to bear in the relationship between the US and Palestine. And we know that this was taken to an extreme by the Trump administration, because now you see shared values. Now you see populism, racism, extremism, xenophobia, Islamophobia, even anti-Semitism and white supremacy, which was encouraged by this extremism. Somehow they forged a very unholy alliance, along with a couple of other people in the world who of their ilk. And they decided that they're going to reposition Israel in the region. They're going to make it a major power. They're going to normalize it. They're going to give it economic advantages, and it should become a major political, military, intelligence and economic power in the region. And that the Palestinian issue can be dismissed by bashing the Palestinians into submission, by just removing the term occupation as though there is no occupation, by legalizing settlements as though international law doesn't exist, by totally disregarding Palestinian lives and how many Palestinians are killed or cruelly imprisoned or threatened or intimidated. It doesn't matter, because we're supposed to become invisible, or as Kushner said, quoting Daniel Pipes, that the Palestinians have to accept the fact of their defeat. So we're supposed to lie down and die quietly. And I've always said we're a nation who has never been defeated. We may be under occupation. We did not wage wars, by the way. But our spirit and our will has never been broken. Have never been broken. So we do not see ourselves as defeated people. We do not behave as defeated people. And we said we refuse to deal with the Trump administration and its lethal extremist agenda. So I think we're the only people who did that. Whole countries, sovereign states, succumbed to Trump and tried to please him and tried to play his game and tried to pander to his ego and so on. We heard this from Europeans, from others. Anyway, and of course Arab countries. But now that Trump has been defeated, I said we all sighed, gave a collective sigh of relief, because in itself, this is important, that Trump is no longer there to make a mockery of human rights, international law, and Palestinian rights, and to act in concert with the Israelis, with this extremist Israeli government, as partners in crime, and to encourage it and enable it. But conversely, we do not see in Biden a savior. And we know that Biden might be tempted, as he's doing, to do several things. One is to go back to the status quo ante. But the status quo ante is precisely what led to this fail, to the, these failed policies on the ground, to the absence of peace, to Israeli empowerment, to Israeli excesses and violence. Had you had an even-handed policy, you may have been able to achieve peace, but the absence of peace is a result of the Israeli-American alliance, in which the Palestinians were treated as, I don't want to say subhuman species, which is how Israel treats us, but as third, fourth class human beings. And that, in a sense, how to deliver the Palestinians to Israel has undermined America's ability to play a constructive role. Now, if you want to go back to that situation where you say, well, I'm for a two-state solution, and if Israel builds settlements, no, you shouldn't do that, naughty, or there are some red lines, or that there are some settlements that you can annex, or we don't know what to do with Jerusalem. No. If you adopt a policy that is clear, that is consistent with international law, and that recognizes the Palestinians as equal with rights, then you might change. But if you go back to this, you know, the placebo thing for the Palestinians, or pressure and threats and blackmail on the Palestinians, while rewards and positive inducements and so on, advance payments for Israel, no, that's not going to work, because you're only encouraging lawlessness and impunity. So the first thing that he needs to do is not just, Biden, is not just stop the policies of Trump and throw that Trump plan into the garbage can where it really belongs, but he should start undoing the realities that Trump has created. Now, he started with the funding, with the finance. Okay, UNRWA was targeted, refugees were targeted by Trump. Now he's slowly restoring some funding for UNRWA, not all, but some, which is crucial, at least from a humanitarian point of view, but from also a legal point of view, as per the obligations of the international community that set up UNRWA to take care of refugees. Started the, you know, restoring some funding for infrastructure and so on, but there have also been resolutions by Congress that are really horrendous and very draconian to tie the hands of anybody who wants to undo this, particularly when it comes to funding. When, I don't want to go into the Taylor Force Act or ATCA or any of these legislation attempts by Congress in order to maintain Israel's control superiority and to maintain Palestine's vulnerability, and it's being open to accountability by the U.S. legal system. That's another issue. But now what we need is to start, as I said, a new discussion, a strategic discussion with the Palestinians. If you can see us as a counterpart with equal rights to Israel, then let's start talking. Don't act as an Israeli agent trying to extract concessions from the Palestinians on behalf of Israel. Israel has tried through violence, through oppression, through killing and home demolitions and so on, to make us surrender, and we didn't. And you cannot start acting nicely and saying, if only you do that, if you change your textbooks, if you do not support your prisoners' families and so on. And they adopted the Israeli definition of terrorism, which is certainly is not the American definition of terrorism. And to us, what we see is state terrorism by Israel. So there has to be a shift. And now that Palestine is part of the discourse in the US, and part of, there's a whole network of solidarity, which is really encouraging and empowering. Within the Democratic Party, there's a progressive faction that understands the reality of the situation and Palestinian rights. But you also have the Democratic majority for Israel, or I think so, in the Democratic Party, that wants to go back and to make the same mistakes over and over again and maintain Israel's impunity and Palestinian vulnerability. This is very dangerous because these policies are doomed to failure the way the previous the policies failed and led to this drastic situation.
Finally, and it touches on what you just said there about the solidarity that exists within, I suppose, a new left within the United States and the Democrats. What would you say to those, just finally, who wish to organize in support of the Palestinian people, not just to show their solidarity, but to put pressure on their respective governments to change tack? What would your advice be, whether it be in Britain or in other in European nations, within those with remaining within the European Union, or within the United States? What's your advice to them?
First of all, is not to be intimidated. It's very important that these solidarity groups and groups who share the same values and attitudes and objectives that we have in terms of human rights, in terms of colonial struggle, in terms of anti-racism and so on, that these are the people who are speaking out, and we are part, as I said, of this conversation, of this collective, if you will, globally. It's not just in the US, it is also in Europe, it is in the UK and so on. Places in the UK like North Ireland and Scotland and so on, where the way ahead of the curve in that sense. And there are other places in the US. It's important that these people not succumb to the attempts at labeling them as anti-Semitic, because right now there's a massive campaign funded by Israel everywhere to label anybody who criticizes Israel as being anti-Semitic. This conflation of criticism with Israel as a state that is acting with full criminality and lawlessness, that if you criticize this, then you are anti-Semitic. This is entirely untrue and misleading, and is a tool for silencing criticism. Two, the adoption of the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, which is, again, entirely false. Three, the labeling of BDS as being anti-Semitic and so on, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. So we know that our allies and people in solidarity with the Palestinian cause have a lot to stand up to. And they do risk a lot when they very courageously stand up for Palestinian rights. But it's happening more and more often. And it's becoming part of a language. This taboo of never mention Palestine or the Palestinian cause is no longer there. It is no longer putting the lid on any type of political discourse or rights discourse when it comes to Palestine. Now, this is happening. So when there is solidarity, when people work together, when the Black Lives Matter movement works along with the women's movement, along with the all other minorities, with the indigenous people's movement, with the human rights people who are acting on these principles, with Jewish organizations that are challenging Netanyahu's and Israel's attempt to say that they have a monopoly on the Jewish voice and saying, no, this is not us, this is not who we are. So this is the type of solidarity that when we work together, we cannot be intimidated or defeated. There has to be a link up between or among these like-minded groups and people of color and people who indigenous people and so on, as I said, the LGBTQ. There are so many organizations who share these objectives and principles. And since we are part of the conversation, I think it's important for whatever administration to listen. Particularly now, the Democrats have to listen to the progressives, and they're not, and that's a serious mistake. And they're attempting to rebuild this unquestioning blind alliance between Israel and the US. This shouldn't happen, or in the West, particularly when accusations of anti-Semitism are so easy to hand out, and these labels are stuck like post-its on people's heads. No, this is important, but it's also important to mobilize and with their own representatives to speak out, because parliaments and Congress and so on are taking decisions relating to foreign policy, and they are allowing Israel to get away with what it's doing. So when parliaments speak out, when you question your representative of whatever party, and when you hold your country accountable as to what you do, selling weapons to Israel or even buying weapons from Israel, cooperating with the settlements and settlement productions, these things are now beginning to be questioned by the public and through them by the parliament and by Congress and so on. We don't have a majority support in the US and US Congress, but there are very clear and qualitative and persuasive voices in Congress that are now speaking out. And they are remarkable. We follow them, we value them, they give us encouragement and we encourage them. But at the same time, also in Europe, the parliaments in Europe have taken more advanced position than the government. And the governments don't even listen to the parliament when it comes to the Palestinians and when it comes to Palestinian rights, whether in recognition of statehood or in holding Israel to account or in providing means of protection for Palestine. So I would say it's important to organize, to work together, to question your representatives, to educate people to stand up and speak out, because for too long the Palestinian narrative has been silenced and or distorted. And the truth must come out, and it must move people to affect decision makers. And it seems to me, once this becomes clear, that there is no preferential treatment, there is no state or country or people who have greater value and privileges and rights than anybody else, and that all we need is for them to say the Palestinians are equal to everybody else. And they have equal rights, and that international law applies, and international humanitarian law applies, and the Fourth Geneva Convention applies, and human rights laws apply, and that Israel, like any other country, has to be held to account. And they cannot continue with this lethal policy that is not just attempting to destroy the Palestinians, but attempting to destroy the stability and security of the whole region, and wreaking havoc in the global rules-based system, because they don't believe in it and they don't participate in it unless it gives them a free hand. So yes, I mean, I cannot give specific advice. I know they're mobilizing, I know they're organizing. I follow a lot of the activities, as I'm sure you do, Owen. And I think it is encouraging, and we should be in touch together, so they should have access to the facts, to what's happening, and to have a shared a narrative and a presentation that is compelling and persuasive and truthful.
Hanan, thank you so, so much for joining us and for speaking in such depth. We really, really appreciate it.
Thank you, Owen. It's my pleasure to talk to you or to be with you in this conversation, and all the more power to you.
Thanks for listening, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that. Do support us on patreon.com/OwenJones84. Help us decide who we talk to, what we talk about, the documentaries we do, and also on the supporter function, which you can see in the description. And leave us 5 stars and a review. It just helps other people listen. And with that, thank you so much. Speak soon.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.